Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your talk show host, Randy Fine. Have you ever missed out on a great opportunity because of bad timing? Paralyzed with fear when faced with making a big life decision? Tap into your intuitive intelligence and make opportunities work for you with today's special guest, Paul O'Brien's Visionary Decision-Making Tools and Advice. The next time a window of opportunity opens, don't miss it because of hesitation. The synchronicity principle can help transition you out of stagnant situations and into more dynamic lifestyles. Paul O'Brien is an author, entrepreneurial strategist, philosopher, and raconteur who invented divination software and created the world's largest astrology and divination e-commerce business. He is the executive director of the Divination Foundation, and for 30 years he has hosted Pathways Radio, an interview program focused on persona and cultural transformation. So I know that that intro is very intriguing, and but you want to hear more from him, so we're going to get started. Let me introduce you. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Randy.
Well, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being my guest.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, good. Good. I'm glad you're with us. You had a lot of you were an entrepreneur, and long before that was even really something, and you created a lot of proprietary gadgets, whatever, and other things. Can you tell us about how you got started?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I actually was the most unlikely entrepreneur because my venture into creating a product and making a business out of it was a labor of love. It wasn't something I set out to do. I never, you know, looked in the back pages of Inc. magazine to figure out how I could go into business for myself. I was in the software industry as a high-tech marketing executive in the late 80s, but that all began in the early 70s when I got a job as a secretary in a computer center because I was absolutely enthralled by the promise of software and the idea that people could write code and deliver immersive experiences. And this was due to me playing a game on this gigantic computer in this nonprofit computer center. It was called a mini computer. It would take up this whole room and have huge mag tapes and a tiny little screen. And my friend was a programmer there. And we'd go there and we'd smoke pot and we'd commandeer this $150,000 machine in the middle of the night that had less power than my iPhone has today. But it turned me on so much. And it wasn't because of the game. The game was fun, but it was the idea of that software could create immersive experiences just fascinated me, turned me on, because I had visions of multimedia back in the 70s. This is, 5 years before Apple even existed and 20 years before CD-ROMs existed. But I thought, people are going to use this for educational purposes or even spiritual purposes. And the other thing I was fascinated with in my youth, which is a theme of my book, in getting in touch with what fascinates you. And the other thing that fascinated me, at the age of 19, I was introduced to this divination system called the I Ching, which is an ancient Chinese book. It translates as the Book of Changes, but it's more than a book. It's the oldest book in the world, but it's much more than a book because it's a system that you can use to stimulate your intuition around issues or questions that logic can't handle, in order to think outside the box. And the ancient Chinese had used, the emperors had used it, the military leaders had used it for timing, in order to time big campaigns or rituals or just make decisions by calling in their unconscious elements, the collective unconscious. So I was fascinated by that since I was 19, and I was fascinated by software. So 15 years later, I got into the software business in the early 70s as a secretary because I could type. So that's how I got into it. And then I kind of just bootstrapped myself into being a marketing specialist. And when I was the VP of marketing in the late 80s, I found myself using the I Ching more often than usual because of all the stress at work and the office politics and such. And we had a rather narcissistic boss who made Steve Jobs look like a dream to work for. And so I was even taking the I Ching to work, and I thought, one day a light bulb went off, and I thought, gosh, I wish I could do this on my computer so it wasn't so conspicuous, instead of having to find a closet to hide in and cast the coins so the engineers wouldn't make fun of me. And that idea sparked this creative surge in me because it was the intersection between two things that had fascinated me, the I Ching and the promise of multimedia. And so I took my life savings and I developed one of the very first multimedia programs, which was an interactive version of the I Ching, of casting an I Ching reading. And I had sound and art in there, even though CD-ROM still didn't exist. We had multiple floppies. It was kind of cumbersome to load it, but it ran on the Macintosh, and I loved it. I thought, wow, this really works. I had figured out a way to cast the coins using a mouse and a keyboard, and it was just a really cool thing, and I fell in love with it, with my own invention. And then I was forced to write my own version of the I Ching because I didn't have the rights to any of them out there. And I thought I could do a good job. I had been trained as a writer, and I'd been studying the I Ching at that point for like 18 years. So that was the first book I wrote, but it actually was embedded in the software, which I called Synchronicity. And I loved it so much, Randy, that I decided to throw caution to the wind. I left a high-paying executive position. I like to say I left money for meaning, because I just wanted to do something that was meaningful to me, that would fulfill my heart, even though there was no money in it, or it didn't seem like there could ever be any money in I Ching software. I thought, well, I might be able to make a living, because I'm a marketing guy. I might be able to figure out how to make a living. So that was my goal, creative freedom, and I defined it very modestly as the ability to make a living doing something I cared about. I never thought it would amount to anything. I just kept at it and basically barely kept it together as a single father and a bootstrap entrepreneur. No investors, no family money. For the next 15 years, I didn't get paid half the time, but we managed to keep it together with paper clips and rubber bands. And when the internet came along, I put my I Ching software on the internet, and I put my by then I had added tarot, do-it-yourself tarot card readings. I put that on the internet, and I talked AOL into featuring them along in their astrology section. And then I added astrology of my own. I hired the world's best astrologers, and eventually got the franchise for AOL horoscopes and Yahoo horoscopes. And all of a sudden, this little company in Portland, Oregon, that was operating out of my basement, started to grow, and it was really stressful, but it was exciting. And we ended up with 10 million registered members, most
wow.
of whom had gravitated from AOL and Yahoo. And at that point, we started to be pursued, and we had become, through the auspices of AOL Horoscopes, the world's largest astrology website, even though the name of the site was tarot.com. And at that point, we started to be pursued by big media companies. Disney came looking to acquire us, and Barnes & Noble was interested. And I said, no. I'm finally making money. I'm finally, I didn't have a need to sell it. It was totally profitable. There was no debt. It was very profitable. But then I started thinking, what would I do if I did sell it and I got my number so that I didn't have to work for a living? I mean, I could just be an investor. And I thought, well, you know, I have a lot of ways that I would apply creative freedom. Now we're talking about really expansive creative freedom. And so I ended up selling the company for millions of dollars and became, you know, very wealthy overnight, even though I didn't have an exit strategy and I wasn't money motivated. I mean, money's important, and it was important to me because nobody ever gave me any. But it's a kind of a cool story. I tell the story in this book, Intuitive Intelligence. I tell that story as an example of doing things that everybody thought was crazy, but I was led by my intuition to follow my heart.
Yes, and I believe at some point in life we all have this feeling, this drive for something, and it's really important to follow that. So you named your book Intuitive Intelligence. What do you mean by intuitive intelligence? What exactly is that?
Well, intuition is a rarefied sense that we have. Everybody's got it. It's been called the sixth sense for thousands of years. And it's the ability to acquire knowledge or insights without recourse to conscious reasoning. It's kind of a direct mode of knowing. And it's kind of a way to directly access the unconscious knowledge that we have inside of us. Or you can think of it as kind of a higher order of pattern recognition, where the intuition reads between the lines and fills in the dots. So it's big picture thinking. I call it visionary thinking, and I call my system visionary decision making, because it depends on a vision, and a vision is stitched together largely using intuition, because you can't know, all the connections are not obvious. So intuition is a sense, it's a very subtle sense that gives us the ability to recognize connections that are not in black and white, that are not fully explicated yet, but it's sort of like in the original astronomers of the hunter-gatherers, and how did they come up with the constellations? You know, they had to fill in the dots, and that's kind of what intuition does. So I think of it as a higher form of intelligence, because it transcends logic, and
right.
it's really a function of the heart more than of the ego.
Right. I absolutely agree with you. So we were talking before we went on air about the fact that you are a narcissistic abuse survivor, as am I and many of my listeners. And we were talking about how important intuition is in healing from that, recognizing it, getting out of it, all these things. And because we really have to trust how we feel, not, you know, over what has been programmed in our head. That's so much more important. So how do you recommend that we begin to get in touch with our intuitive intelligence? What are some of the ways we can do that?
Well, that's what part two of the book is about. I call it the visionary decision-making process. And I'm really focusing the book on using intuition to make decisions. And so it's really kind of a book about strategic decision-making. In fact, the subtitle is Make Life-Changing Decisions with Perfect Timing. And so I'm focused on decision-making. And in order to do that and to do these large decisions, you know, the big picture things, like maybe different life-changing decisions that we are confronted with, like changing careers or what career to go into in the first place, or should I get married, or should I move to this other part of the country, are these big decisions. Logic doesn't really cut it. It's not enough. Logic can help. And there's two parts to a strategic decision like that. There's the what question, and there's the when question. The what question is, what's the best move to make now? And the when question is, or the what question is, what's the next best move to make? And the when question is, and when should I do it? So it's like if you're confronted with the need to have a heart-to-heart talk or a difficult talk with somebody in your life, like maybe your teenage child or maybe your lover or whatever, timing is important. You don't want to have that talk when, you know, they're suffering because they just lost their job or you know, timing is an important consideration. That's the when question. So I have processes in the book that help us answer those two questions. The what question can use logic. Logic can be very helpful. I like to define divination as a way to stimulate your intuition around problems that logic can't handle. But there's a lot of problems that logic can handle. And if people, you know, explain to me some problem or dilemma that they're faced with, and we go through the logical analysis process, and it becomes obvious, the answer can be obvious, but they're looking for a different answer because they've got some emotional attachment to some fantasy or some different dream that flies in the face of the concrete reality. This certainly happens to people when they're involved with narcissists. They don't know they're involved with a narcissist because narcissists are very good at putting up a facade that can be extremely charming, and they're great at gaslighting, and which is basically making you think you're the crazy one. And you know, it's a very, narcissism is like one of the most airtight defensive structures that the ego could possibly have, and it's
right.
Very difficult to see through it. And so,
right.
But somebody else can see through it. Somebody else can help you see through it. And so logic can help with that, but a lot of times we are overcome with our attachment, and it triggers stuff that came out of our childhood and that kind of thing. So
right.
What question,
right.
Logic can help, but the when question is like 100% intuitive. When to pull the trigger, when to execute the action that a decision would point to, that is 100% intuitive, and that's where people really do miss those windows of opportunities that you mentioned in the introduction. Either they're too emotional and impulsive, and they just want to get it over with and seize the dream, or they're hesitant and procrastinating while they're waiting for more information and they want to do more analysis. So these are the ways that we go wrong when it comes to decision making, and and intuition can help us cut through that if we learn to trust it and we learn to cultivate intuitive intelligence. So you ask me, how do we do that? Well, you can't force it. This is the paradox. You can't force intuition to happen when you need it, especially when you need it the most. Because when you need it the most is usually when you're stressed out and there's strong feelings, maybe fear,
right.
Craving, or addiction, or something like that. And that's when you need to make a change, and intuition can point the way, but you can't access it because there's too much noise in the system. There's emotional noise. There's the mental chattering within the mind. There's all of the input that we're bombarded with through the five senses. God, it's hard to think straight, let alone feel straight. And so intuition never shows up in that way, in the way of a strong feeling. I have this, I jokingly refer to something I call O'Brien's Law, and it's in the book, and it says that the stronger the feeling, the less trustworthy it is as a basis for skillful decision making. And that just blows people's minds, because we think, well, the stronger the feeling, that's a great sign. That's what I got to go with. But intuition, that's the strong feelings are coming from the ego. It's usually fear or craving or something like that. The intuition takes a form of a much more subtle gut feeling or a vision or a little or a sound or you hear something. It's very subtle. It's very quiet. It's a very fine frequency. And we can't even hear it with all the noise that's bombarding us, all of our senses, all of the time, unless we tamp things down, unless we can calm down and allow that little antenna, which is the intuitive sense, enough noise-free environment so that we can tune it in. So some of the techniques I talk about in different chapters in part two are ways to become more aware of intuition and to become more sensitized to the signals that life is sending us in the form of synchronicity.
Right. So, yeah, and that's exactly what I was getting ready to ask you about. So in your book, you talk about Carl Jung and the synchronicity principle. You talk about that a lot, which I really like, because for me, synchronicities have really defined the path of my life. And I believe that, you know, when we pay attention to the signposts, the things that are guiding us, often it takes us in a very, very positive direction. But you talk also about our relationship to infinite intelligence. So the collective unconscious, that kind of thing. So let's first talk about the synchronicity principle. How does that work for us in reaching our goals?
Well, Carl Jung is the greatest depth psychologist that ever lived, in my opinion. And he defined the synchronicity principle. He also highlighted this thing called archetypes, which are structures, psychological structures that exist in the unconscious and also in what he called the collective unconscious. And so in the first part of the book, I explain these things. There's a whole chapter on synchronicity, which is basically the secret of perfect timing. It's actually the definition of perfect timing. And I talk about infinite intelligence in chapter four, which is what I refer to, which is how I refer to the collective unconscious. And that's this resource that's available to us if we, where we can actually download or channel archetypes that are inside of us too. All the archetypes are inside of us. So let's just put it in the context of a divination system like the I Ching or tarot cards. What you've got is a set of archetypes and operated on by the synchronicity principle. Well, the synchronicity principle states that things are related in time, not just in space. And we don't usually credit time as an important factor in the logical Western scientific method. We don't consider it at all. If you do a controlled experiment on Tuesday night and you do that same controlled experiment Friday morning, you expect to get exactly the same result because time has been factored out of the equation. But the ancient sages realized that timing was very important, that they were trying to answer a different question than what are things made of, which is what modern science answers. They were asking the question, what things want to go together in time, and when is the best time to do things, like launch a campaign or have a marriage or whatever big thing is coming up. And so they were looking for signs that would indicate that. Now, synchronicities, Carl Jung defined synchronicities as meaningful coincidences. So these are those amazing little coincidences that happen in everybody's life, and most of the time we dismiss them as a mere coincidence, not a meaningful coincidence. We don't see the meaning in it. And that's the function of the intuition, is to, when we notice a synchronicity or we notice an amazing coincidence, we decipher the meaning using our intuition, which connects the dots. It allows us to read between the lines. And like you use the word signpost, that's beautiful, because synchronicities are signs and omens, like they mentioned in the Old Testament. These are signs and omens of, they're signals that give us some sense of a possible different way to go outside the box that we're stuck in. When this happens in life, we need to pay attention to it, and then we need to contemplate it. We need to create some space for our intuition to operate on it so that we can sense the meaning of it. So I like to think of the intuitive sense as a way to decipher meaning by reading between the lines, whether it's poetry, whether it's a synchronicity, whether it's a divination reading. It's the reading between the lines is where you find the meaning, and particularly the meaning for you. So this is the whole skill, is if we can learn to notice synchronicities, we will realize that they're happening all the time. Everything is in sync except for our ego. And so we can learn to be in sync by honoring those signals, paying attention to them, and then they start showing up all the time, because they are happening all the time. We just start to notice them more often, and
right.
It really leads to what I call the synchronistic lifestyle, where little miracles are happening for us much more easily and much more often.
I agree with you. When you begin to pay attention to them, you really see that there's so many. And I agree with you. I do call them miracles, because people say, you know, they're looking for these great big miracles in their life. Miracles happen constantly. They happen all the time. We just have to be aware. We just have to tap into that. So the collective unconscious, is that more of the spirit world, the universe? How would you define that?
Well, Napoleon Hill, who wrote the book Think and Grow Rich, he called it infinite intelligence, and that's what I call it. The reason that Carl Jung called it the collective unconscious is because he was differentiating from the personal unconscious, which Freud had defined. And Freud had defined the personal unconscious as this reservoir of dark energies and animalistic urges, and called it, you know, the id. And he had a very kind of pessimistic view of the unconscious mind as being the source of all of our problems. Now, that could be true on a personal level, but Carl Jung, who originally was a associate of Freud's, he broke away from Freud on this issue because he said, hey, there's a lot more going on in the unconscious than just these problematic urges, that there's creativity, there's all kinds of miraculous little things that happen, synchronicities appear, and he basically saw that the unconscious was also the source of insights and new ideas and implicit knowledge, and there was a lot of positive stuff in there that he basically wanted to help people access, and that's why he went into dream interpretation, was one of his specializations, and he had a much broader view of the unconscious. And then he realized, because he studied all these different cultures and mythologies in the religions of the world, that archetypes of human existence, of human behavior, of human energies are universal. They would show up in the dreams of hunter-gatherers, and they'd show up in the dreams of this culture. So they were cross-culture, and they were universal sets of archetypes that human beings respond to or identify with. So he called that the collective unconscious, which was a much bigger concept of the unconscious mind, and he focused on the potentialities that are there for us. And I like to call it our set of resources that's always available to us if we just tap into it. So it's kind of nice and reassuring to think that, wow, we've got all kinds of resources to tap into if we learn how to channel archetypes. The archetypes are in the collective unconscious, but they're also in our unconscious. And you take like tarot cards, there's 78 cards, that's 78 archetypes. You I Ching, you have 64 hexagrams, it's a set of 64 archetypes. Well, the archetype theory states that all those archetypes are inside of you. All of those potentialities are inside of you. And they're not all warm and fuzzy. Some of them are shadowy and challenging, but they're all inside of you, so that when you do a tarot card reading or an I Ching reading, it's pulling up an archetype that's reflecting a part of you. And that gives you some ammunition for contemplation. And it's got a message, and presumably has a message for you. The archetype that comes up for you when you are focused on a question or issue or dilemma that logic can't handle, that archetype is a part of you. So you're looking at a part of yourself, and you're realizing what it means for you in the context of the question that you were asking. So that's kind of how divination works. It's invoking, it's basically using archetypes. But I go in the book, I've got a whole chapter on how to invoke archetypes when you need them, and particularly the foundational archetypes like the sovereign, which is the king or the queen, or the magician, which is the creative part, or the lover, or the warrior. Everybody's got a warrior, and that the warrior isn't aggressive. It basically defends the boundaries when needed. I mean, there's no more fierce warrior than a mama grizzly, and of defending her cubs. So we all have the warrior. We all have these archetypes inside of us, and I'm positing in my book that we can learn to channel them consciously whenever we want to, and that's sort of like linking up with the collective unconscious, as if your intuition were a wireless antenna and it's downloading energies from above or from, you know, the infinite intelligence.
Interesting. You talk about prayer as one way to co-create with this power, but you say that you see it in a different way, not in the way that maybe anyone has been religiously taught how to pray. So, what is your take or your approach to praying?
Well, I think of prayer as kind of half the equation of communing with the divine. I think it's a great thing to do. I do it all the time. But not the way I was taught to do it in Catholic school, which is basically to beg God for favors that I don't really deserve and that I'm desperate for. So most prayer is so, it really smacks of low self-esteem. So I like to think of prayer as basically positing a vision or presenting a vision in my mind that I'm grateful for already. Because if I can conjure up the vision and it's an authentic vision that represents my heart rather than my ego and its various desires and cravings, then that's a creative act. That's like the law of attraction. That's how we get the law of attraction to move, is we channel a vision. Well, that we can pray for that, and we can also have gratitude for that. I actually have developed, 30 years ago, long before The Secret ever came out, I had this manifestation treatment that I was using and teaching people. And it's on my website, divination.com, under the resources section, so that people can download a word version, a text version of it, and then edit it to make it their own. And basically, it's a form of prayer, but it also involves meditation. So I think of prayer and meditation as being two sides of the same coin. The prayer is the expression to and with the divine, and the meditation is the listening part of it. And divination is kind of like that. Divination is a form of prayer or a form of meditation, but it's like a two-way communication, because you're basically, you have something on your mind, something that you want insight about or guidance, and you put that out there, and then you get an answer. And that answer isn't really telling you exactly what to do, and it's certainly not predicting the future, but it's stimulating your intuition to think outside the box and open your mind for various different possible solutions. So I think that prayer and meditation go together, and that what we're doing is we're communing with the divine. We're channeling infinite intelligence. I don't use the word God a lot, but it's okay. God, the source, higher power, whatever you want to call it, is operating through us, not just on us or for us. It's actually inside of us, inside of everything. And so if we can get in touch with that divine energy that can flow through us and channel that, that's kind of a higher form of prayer, in my opinion.
So I learned a while ago, and this is sort of along the same line, that instead of asking for something to, and as you said, to use gratitude. So I will say thank you for bringing me, this $100 or whatever it is, as if it's already existed. And and I find that when I use that approach, things happen quite rapidly.
Yeah, that's right, because you're not in the way. You know, if you're just begging for something, you're coming from scarcity, and you're actually reinforcing the scarcity aspect of your situation.
Right, right. Exactly.
But when you say thank you...
Right.
I used to plead
with God and the universe and everything. I used to plead, why aren't you helping me? Why aren't you helping me? And when I started saying thank you for helping me, it all changed.
I have a thing in the book where I actually key on that, and I say that's what faith is. Faith isn't just magical thinking and blindly believing in anything. Faith is a psychic sense of what's in process right now, whether there's any visible or tangible proof yet or not. That's my definition of faith. So
that's a good definition.
Yeah, and so when you say thank you, God, for this thing that I'm focusing on, even before it's manifest, even before it's obviously manifest, what you're doing is affirming the fact that it's coming toward you, that you're attracting it, because it's for your good. And that's what I call faith. That's really practical faith, having that psychic sense that you're attracting what you need and it's being provided.
Yes, and, not everybody is into, tapping into that realm, but I am very strong. I mean, for me, it guides my life, so I'm right with you on that. So what else did you want to share about your book or your philosophy? So your book is Intuitive Intelligence, Make Life-Changing Decisions with Perfect Timing. What else did you want to share with us?
Well, I think the whole question of timing is a fascinating question, and how do we improve our timing? People always ask me, what exercises can I do to improve my timing? And I say, well, all you have to do is cultivate your intuitive intelligence. As your intuition improves, your timing will automatically improve, because the timing question, which is the when question, is 100% intuitive. So you're going to make better decisions with better timing, the more you can access your intuition when you need it the most. And so it's really important to practice mindfulness exercises, or use divination as an excellent way to access intuition, because you have to read between the lines to make sense of it. So I teach people how to use divination. I have this I Ching system that I developed, which is kind of an excellent form of divination. I think the I Ching is an excellent form of divination because you don't need to have a lot of training. Like, tarot cards are a lot more challenging. Those 78 archetypes haven't really been written up in a book form very often. But the I Ching was a book from the very beginning. So it's something that you can do by yourself that you don't need a reader to help you with. And you can actually read one version or another of the I Ching. I did a modern, non-patriarchal, non-militaristic, non-sexist version, which I call the Visionary I Ching, which is available in an app form. Visionary I Ching app for iPhones or Android, which is a really kind of a convenient way to do it. And we also have it on my website, divination.com, so people can go and look up various different hexagrams if they want to use coin, do it in the traditional way. But I encourage people to learn how to do one divination modality or another. And, of course, I promote the I Ching because you don't need – you can do it on your own, and you can learn to do it on your own without a lot of training. And that is a great way to cultivate your intuition, to do an I Ching reading. Some people do them every morning as a meditation. And so just the effort is a lot of wisdom. I mean, there's timeless wisdom in this incredible oracle. And so I do that sometimes, or I do it around the issues that logic can't handle. And what are those issues? Well, they're some of the most important areas of life, like relationships, like getting away from a narcissist, like negotiating, you know, even business deals, anything to do with timing. You know, I will a lot of times just ask a question, what is the best approach to take vis-a-vis XYZ? Or if I'm in a relationship that's getting confusing, I might just enter the person's name and then see what kind of reflection I get. So it's kind of a mirror for your energies. And I discovered that the first time I ever did it. I was 19 years old, and I was a smart aleck. And this young lady was showing me this system and encouraging me to ask a question. And I didn't, you know, I was just making fun of it. I wasn't taking it seriously. And I cast my first I Ching reading, and I got back hexagram number 4. Which is entitled Youthful Folly. The student lacks respect for the teacher. And I thought, wait a minute, let me try that again. And this time I was testing it, and it came back with some text that said, questioning the sincerity of the seeker. And it was testing me. I thought, wow, I make fun of this, and it makes fun of me. I test it, it tests me. And that's when I gained respect for it and started studying it and using it for the rest of my life to inform every major decision.
Yeah. We're going to run out of time. I could talk to you all day about this because I'm so on the same wavelength as you, but you have some really interesting things that that I'm learning from as I go through this book. And so I encourage my listeners to pick up a copy of Intuitive Intelligence because it is so full of practical information for really just, it's not only about making life-changing decisions, it's just about guiding your life. So thank you, Paul, for writing such an excellent book and especially for being my guest today and sharing it with us.
Well, thank you for having me on, Randy, and thank you for doing your show. It's such a gift to the world, and I'm grateful for it. And on behalf of humanity, I'm grateful for it. So thank you once again.
Oh, you are welcome. What a great way to end the show. Okay, Paul, be well. Take care. Thanks.
Very much. Bye.
So we are out of time today, but if you have any comments or questions about today's show, you can email me at loveyourlife@randyfine.com. That's RANDIFINE.com. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.